statute, specifically Chapter 3 of the Delaware Criminal Code, Title 11, provides a mandatory statutory scheme for consideration of evidence of a defendant's guilt and any defenses at trial. Section 301 states the standard for the state to show proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Section 302 addresses jury instructions relevant to that standard. 302A provides the basic instruction on reasonable doubt. 302B states, if Your Honor will permit me to quote, the defendant may produce whatever evidence the defendant has tending to negate the existence of any element of the offense. And if the court finds a reasonable juror might believe the evidence, the defendant is entitled to a jury instruction that the jury must consider whether the evidence raises a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. Section 303, Your Honor, addresses defenses that a defendant can raise of a non-affirmative sort. Section 303C, if some credible evidence supporting defense is presented, the defendant is entitled to a jury instruction that the jury must acquit the defendant if they find the evidence raises a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. 304, Your Honors, addresses the standard for affirmative defenses. So we have a scheme here that the legislature provided us in these first four sections of Chapter 3.
Well, how does the statute interact with our decision in Jackson?
Your Honors, Jackson stated as I understand it, that the court must provide a defense or must provide an instruction on alibi when that evidence has been raised by the defense. And the main concern that the court had was how is the jury going to weigh this evidence? Is the jury going to think perhaps that a defendant has to prove his alibi, has to persuade us that we're satisfied that he has shown us an alibi here? And the court was careful to note that we cannot allow jurors to speculate on that because alibi is not a defense that the defendant has any burden on. The jury has to be instructed that if it raises any reasonable doubt in the state's case, that's the instruction that the jury must be given to avoid any risk of speculation. So,
if we look at the Superior Court's post-trial opinion, I don't see any citation to Jackson. When you were asking for the alibi, or when the request was made at trial for the alibi instruction,
yes, Your Honor,
were the statutes that you just reviewed and Jackson cited to the Superior Court? And does the record reflect why the Superior Court concluded it would not follow Jackson?
Your Honor, the authority I'm describing here, Jackson, Section 303, was not cited to the court, as I understand it, in specificity at the in prayer conference.
Well, was the request, the standard pattern and jury instruction 7.C1, which reads, in this case, the defendant has raised the defense of alibi to the charge, and then you fill in the name of the charge. The defendant contends that when the crime was allegedly committed, he/she was somewhere other than the place where the crime was allegedly committed. If the evidence on this point raises in your mind a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, you must give him/her the benefit of that doubt and return a verdict of not guilty. Was that the alibi instruction requested? The only sentence that seems to be quoted in the record matches the last sentence of that.
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand it, I asked for a record as far as was a recording of it made of the proposed instruction, for example. And there was no text in the record that I could refer it to. So I only know from my trial counsel that something was handed up in chambers to the effect, and it was discussed in chambers. But the effect of it being made a part of the record, it's not apparent in the transcript that it was made a part of the record, Your Honor. It was an actual text that was discussed in chambers, Your Honor.
This was an off-the-record prayer conference?
It was, no, Your Honor, it was on the record, but the text that was being handled, as I understand it, was not identified.
That's not beyond the file, the form anywhere?
What do you mean beyond the form?
As I understand it, there's a form instruction, as I'm referring to, 7 point, whatever it may be. And so the form language that provides the alibi defense language instruction was the basis for the request.
So you're telling us that trial counsel requested the pattern instruction for alibi?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which would be more than the one sentence that actually is quoted from the record, which is the simple sentence, if the evidence on this point raises in your mind a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, you must give him the benefit of that doubt. The reason I ask that question, it sounds like the trial judge took that sentence alone and said, that's talking to or speaking to one part of the evidence. If I did it for this, I'd have to do it for all the evidence in the case. And instead, I'm giving a general instruction that says, if you have a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt, then you should find him not guilty. Isn't that what happened?
That's what happened, Your Honor, as I read it also.
Are you suggesting that what Justice Ridgely pointed out to be the only written part of the record that we have is incomplete in that it didn't contain the entire proffered alibi instruction? By saying that they relied on the pattern instruction that Justice Ridgely also quoted? Are you confident that that's what happened?
I'm not confident, Your Honor. I did ask trial counsel to be here, and perhaps I can find a little bit more out about that, Your Honor, when I sit down.
Well, you have some time reserved for rebuttal, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor. So in terms of the mechanics in that prayer conference, Your Honor, I'm sorry I haven't addressed that fully. I'll address that more fully in rebuttal. I would submit that there was a quantum of evidence produced pursuant to Gutierrez to warrant an instruction. And the trial court was bound to prevent any kind of improper handling of the evidence by the jury in its deliberations. And regardless of the quality of the request, I would submit the court should have given the instruction.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of Appellant Anderson Brown. Excuse me. Just to further our discussion on the alibi defense instruction, I was actually one of the trial counsels in this case, and I will say that while I cannot confidently state on my own that it was a pattern jury instruction, a piece of paper was handed to the judge with the actual instruction. Mr. Figliola gave it to her, and he asserts that it was the pattern jury instruction. Jackson was not cited to the court at that time. However, at A81, it is cited in the Mr. Brown's motion for a new trial. In my brief, it explains that his legal arguments went unaddressed, and they did, in fact, go unaddressed, as the court has pointed out at that particular time. It is important for this court to note that the law is very strong in Delaware, as well as many other jurisdictions, that an alibi instruction is required. And in fact, this court in Gardner, makes it clear that even if there were not a request, even if this court finds that the record is inadequate with respect to what was requested, this is reversible error. This court has held that it is plain error for there to be no request given when there is sufficient evidence in the record and when the law is stated correctly. There's been no suggestion by
Ms. Walker, before you get to that, I know you said Jackson cited in the motion for a new trial, but it seems in a case like this where the holding in Jackson seems so clear that it would be helpful for trial counsel to say to the trial judge, here's my request for an alibi instruction. And in support of that request, I rely on Jackson, which says it's mandatory. Looking at this record on appeal, one gets the impression the whole case might have taken a different track if the court would have had Jackson at the same time the request was made for the instruction.
Perhaps that's correct, Your Honor. However, the judge did take time to go in the back, as she stated, to consider the law. While neither defendants actually cited to Jackson, I think because it was a pattern jury instruction and the law was clear, that may not have been raised at that time.
Do the pattern jury instructions have annotations?
I believe they do, and I'm not sure.
Wouldn't Jackson logically be found in the pattern jury instructions?
I believe so. Jackson and Gardner as well. I don't know that in particular was handed to the judge. with the annotations. I think perhaps it may have been typed up.
Well, I'm just thinking, it's been a while since I've been a trial judge, but logic would suggest to me that if someone's asked me to give an instruction and I was going to go back in chambers and research it, the first place I would go would be the pattern jury instructions. And if there was an annotation as a part of the pattern jury instruction that a trial lawyer had suggested should be given, I would look at those cases.
I agree, Your Honor. And that's not to excuse that our failure to actually cite that. However, the court is in a position under Gardner v. State to give the instruction even if it's not requested. The court also had another opportunity to remedy its decision in the motion for a new trial where Jackson was cited. In fact, I do believe the court at the hearing pointed out that we hadn't presented any case law. However, she was then presented with case law at that time and didn't discuss Jackson in its opinion. In her
did
opinion.
Anyone cite 302B, which says the defendant may produce whatever evidence he has tending to negate the existence of any element of the offense, and if the court finds that a reasonable juror might believe that evidence, the defendant is entitled to a jury instruction that the jury must consider whether the evidence raises a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt?
I'm not sure whether that was cited to the court or not, Your Honor, but that is the correct statement of the law, which, again, had the trial court looked at the law, had the trial court examined the case of Jackson v. State and the cases cited by defense counsel in the motion for new trial, that would have been included therein.
Well, does that subsection of Section 302 contemplate an alibi instruction and an instruction that the jury must consider whether the evidence raises a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, that evidence?
I believe it does. I think 302 and 303 actually address two separate situations. A lot of jurisdictions consider alibi a defense, which would be covered under 303. But a lot of jurisdictions says no, it's just evidence presented to negate an element. So either way, under 302, if the court were to consider it to be evidence presented by the defendant, 302 would apply and 303 would apply if it was considered an official defense. And in this court,
it's not an affirmative defense.
It's not an affirmative defense. You are correct.
So 303 doesn't.
Okay. So it is not an affirmative defense. Therefore, there is the more need under 302. And the primary basis for this need is that the jury is left to assume that the defendant has a burden to prove the alibi defense. And the major concern is this case. This is the primary case of which this court and other jurisdictions have been concerned about, is a credibility case. It is very clear from the record the state relied on two witnesses who had many, many, many credibility issues. And the courts have held that the concern with respect to alibi defense instruction is that a jury might disbelieve an alibi and overlook the state's inability to prove beyond reasonable doubt all the elements against the defendant. It's possible that while the jury may have actually had questions about the credibility of the two main witnesses that the state presented, they may have equally, if not more so, had issues with respect to Mr. Brown's and or Mr. Dillard's witnesses and therefore stated, well, if I don't believe them, then he must be covering something up. He must have done it. And that's the concern that this court has expressed. And even one decision, Rogers versus State, where this court said, yeah, there was an error, but it was harmless error because there was overwhelming state evidence. The District of Delaware corrected that decision, reversed that decision, and said, no, he was entitled to that. And several, and that's Rogers versus Redmond. And in several jurisdictions, federal and state, have all said, just as this court has stated in Wonin versus State, Gutierrez versus State, as long as there's some credible evidence in the record when a defendant asks for an instruction on a defense, and it's not limited to affirmative defenses, when they request instruction on a defense, they are entitled to it. And they are also entitled to instructions with respect to any evidence that negates the element of the offense. And here, Ms. Gardner in particular gave very specific testimony, contrary to what the state asserts in its brief. She was very specific. She said, Mr. Brown was with me the day of the 26th through the 27th up through 10 o'clock. Now, she doesn't express whether it was 10 a.m. or 10 p.m., Either way, it was well past midnight on the 27th, which is when this murder occurred. She stated very specifically where they were at. They were at her father's house in Philadelphia, different state, obviously. They were sleeping together. They had sex together. They ate, and they watched TV. So she was very specific. So any kind of argument that it was vague, therefore not sufficient, must fail.
Why isn't it harmless error for failure to give the instruction?
It's not harmless error because, as I stated, in this particular case, credibility was central. There was no physical evidence whatsoever. There were witnesses who gave, each of them gave three separate versions. Excuse me, Ruth Ann Clark gave three separate versions of what happened. Joanne Brown, the entire time, was consistent that Mr. Brown, she didn't see him. She never implicated him. These were two women who were admitted crack addicts. These were two women who stated they were, one in particular, she was as high as a cootie bird when this happened. So it was very clear that...
So you're saying the closeness of the case.
The closeness of the case, the credibility, the fact that the living victim was unable to identify the assailants, in fact, the victim who did die was questioned before he passed away, and he was not able to identify them.
What about the fact that the other instructions do say the state has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of all the elements?
In Booz versus United States versus Booz, which is the Third Circuit, and also Hudson versus State in Florida, have both held that those general instructions do not overcome or cure the fact that a specific instruction wasn't given. And the fact that 302 exists contemplates the fact that in addition to the generic instructions, specific instructions should be given upon request. Would the court like to address any of the other issues, or would it wish to
hear? You have 5 minutes. It's your 5 minutes.
I would like to address shortly the improper comments made by the state. Admittedly, there was no objection made at the time. However, the prosecutors did in their closing and rebuttal arguments make repeated statements that the two main witnesses, these crack addicts, were scared for their lives. However, they had questioned both of these addicts repeatedly, and they had repeatedly responded that they were not scared and that they were testifying truthfully. In fact, with respect to Ruth Ann Clark, prosecutor asked her 7 times in a row, are you scared, are you scared, are you scared, are you scared? And she said, no, I'm not scared. Are you afraid for your life? No, I'm not. Are you testifying truthfully? Yes, I am. Joanne Brown, are you scared? No, I can't implicate Mr. Brown because I didn't see him there. But then they go on in their actual...
Does the jury have to believe that testimony?
No, they do not. But the state cannot then go and misstate the evidence that they were was scared. Excuse me. There were two people here that were scared for their lives, Joanne and Ruth.
Doesn't the trial judge say that there was sufficient evidence in the record to support the references to Joanne and Ruth being afraid to testify?
That was incorrect. There was nothing ever indicated in the record that they were scared to testify.
But she did find that in her order on page 13, didn't she?
That's an incorrect finding.
There are no facts to support that.
That's correct. The only testimony that remotely comes close to that is Detective DiClemente testified that in these neighborhoods they don't get a lot of cooperation because people are afraid to talk to the police. No one ever said that these women fell into that category. Ruth said that in that neighborhood it's not good to talk to the police. She never said it's because of telling the truth and that's why she's scared. That was never stated by either one of those witnesses. In fact, any comment as to coercion or anything was their concern that at least Ruth had been put in jail because she didn't cooperate at Andrew Brown's trial. Of most concern is the improper gestures made by the prosecutors that they themselves later admitted was improper. During their comments during their closing, they said, their family is here, their family and friends. They have to look at these two defendants. And they implied that they had been threatened, at least by somebody in the courtroom or somewhere else.
What do we do about the fact that today you're saying this is dramatic, objectionable, and reversible error, and yet when defense counsel was sitting there watching it, no one jumped up and said this is improper?
That is problematic, Your Honor. However, this court has repeatedly found plain error, most specifically in Baker versus State, when the evidence has been misstated, where there's been gross improper conduct. I would also state that the remedy that would have been requested at that time would have been a mistrial, and it was at the closing of the trial, and right on the heels of that, the motion for a new trial, which included this argument, was made.
But that sounds like trial strategy, that defense counsel could either object, ask for a curative instruction, ask for a mistrial, or let it go and deal with it when it was their turn to address the jury.
I will state candidly to the court that there's no strategic reason for not having objected at that time to what the state was saying. The questions were allowed because we wanted the jury to hear her repeatedly say that she wasn't scared. But for them to then come forth and mistake the facts and evidence.
Well, it's one thing, isn't it, to say the record doesn't support, through the facts developed in evidence, the prosecutor's argument in summation. It's another thing to ask an appellate court to find objectionable gestures that a prosecutor made that we never saw and that the defense counsel never pointed out on the record at the time were as you described them today.
They were.
That's pretty problematic for us, isn't it?
It is. However, it was placed in the record at the hearing for the new trial where the court acknowledged that there were improper gestures. The state acknowledged they were improper gestures as they commented on the evidence. And, in fact, while it is not proper for defense counsel to roll the dice and then try to cure it after the fact if they didn't like the result, the prosecutors equally cannot make what they believe to be improper comments and come back and say it was harmless. And, in fact, just finally, on appeal, the state seems to concede more than was conceded below by stating that it was improper for the prosecutors to make gestures to insinuate, to create an inference of the actual improper evidence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'd like to emphasize right from the outset that this is purely a state law question. There's two kinds of problems that can arise in the alibi instruction area. One is that the alibi instruction is given that shifts the burden of proof, the burden of persuasion to the defendant. That's the constitutional problem, and that's one of the main problems with an alibi instruction.
Can you help us on what the actual request was? Was it the pattern instruction request that I read earlier?
The actual request is quoted by the judge.
Well, one sentence of it was.
And it's also in Ms. Walker's opening brief. And that is this. I'm reading from the quote in the brief. In the appendix, Ms. Walker's appendix, it's A71. The judge says, I have reviewed the alibi instruction. The operative part of it says, quote, if the evidence on this point raises in your mind a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, you must give him the benefit of that doubt and return a verdict of not guilty.
Well, that matches exactly the last sentence of the three-sentence pattern instruction. Were the other two sentences requested, or do you agree that
the judge says, does emphasize this is the operative part of the instruction. Presumably there was something else in the instruction. I have no reason to believe that they didn't offer the pattern jury instruction as written. I don't think it's ever identified as a pattern jury instruction.
I take it the request itself wasn't made a part of the record. The piece of paper,
no. No, I certainly don't have it. It wasn't in the file, our file.
Well, let's put aside for a moment the quality of the alibi defense.
No.
Just put that aside. Doesn't Jackson hold that if you present a legitimate alibi defense, you're entitled to the instruction?
If there is, yes, according under the statute and under Jackson, some credible evidence, obviously, to support the instruction. The judge is always the gatekeeper of whether the evidence is credible, believable, or not.
So under the current state of the law, the appropriate response to the alibi instruction would be to either give it or put on the record why the court concludes the alibi evidence didn't justify the instruction.
Yes, under current state law, that is correct. No argument with that whatsoever.
So we have a situation in this appeal where the conduct doesn't comport with Jackson.
Yes.
And we need to conclude whether it was a harmless error.
Yes, that is mine. And I emphasize again, this is a state law question, so the harmless error is harmless error. That's it. Not harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt.
I thought in Van Arsdale, our court adopted the California versus Chapman harmless error standard as the Delaware harmless error standard.
Well,
so they'd be the same.
In that case, I've always thought they were.
I'm pretty sure that's what the court held in Van Arsdale.
Yes. But anyway, it is purely a state law question, regardless of the standard the court uses. It's a state law standard to address a state law question.
But the reason I ask for that distinction is because Chapman says when you're concluding something as harmless, you have to conclude that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And my reading of our holding in Van Arsdale as a matter of Delaware state constitutional law is that we adopted the same standard.
I certainly cannot disagree. This court looks at the harmless error, whether or not it's harmless beyond a reason. Thank you for reminding me of that. I've forgotten totally about Van Arsdale. Anyway, it is subject to a harmless error analysis. I mentioned that Jackson seemed to indicate that it's almost per se error. And my friend Ms. Walker, in her reply brief, cites an interesting Ninth Circuit case, Zuniga, which comes right out and says that the failure to give an alibi instruction is per se reversible error. Now, Zuniga caused a great deal of consternation in the state of California, which has always taken kind of a, well, yes, you can give the alibi instruction if you want, but if you don't, it's covered by the general instructions anyhow, so it's really
but
no problem.
It would be helpful to us today to focus on the distinction about whether you need to give it on request or sua sponte. Jackson, our case, seems to say you're entitled to it on request if you have evidence to support it.
Yes.
Then in Gardner, we said, if you don't give it sua sponte, it's not necessarily going to be reversible error. But it didn't seem to detract from the primary holding in Jackson, which is our case, and that's the rule on request.
No,
so how do we deal with the fact that it was requested in this case and not given?
Look at Gardner, whether it's requested or not, it still has to be reviewed for plain error. Going back to Jackson, where Jackson seemed to indicate.
Well, it's not plain error. It would be harmless error.
If requested. If requested and not given, it's reviewed for harmless error. If no request and not given, I suppose plain error. But Jackson seems to indicate that whether the instruction is a necessary one. Now, I'm not so sure that, this is certainly not the last word on the subject here, and certainly needs some clarification, whether the ball is in the defendant's court when he raises the alibi defense to actually ask for the instruction, or whether the duty is upon the judge to give the instruction, whether asked for or not, like other instructions, simply all the mandatory instructions.
Why is that an issue here? There was an instruction requested, and the trial judge's reason for not giving it has nothing to do with the case law's basis for not giving it.
In this case?
Yeah.
Yes, the judge didn't think that an alibi instruction was appropriate, saying that basically her position is the one that's been adopted by several states, and by no means the majority, Texas, Kansas, and Illinois, that the alibi instruction should not be given because it emphasizes certain evidence, and always runs the danger of...
Well, we all agree, based on your acknowledgement earlier in your presentation this morning,
yes,
that Jackson was not followed, based on the current state of the law, that would be an error.
Yes.
So in this case, in this appeal, we're focusing on whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes.
Help us with that answer.
I'm sorry?
Help us decide that.
All right. Now I have to go into the quality of the alibi defenses. Now, I note in Gardner, particularly apropos to Mr. Dillard's defense, Tiara Flannery, who stated that she went to bed. Now, she always gave her times within a half an hour because she wasn't sure. So it depended on when the television show was over. TV show that she watches all the time is either over at 11, 11:30. Her daughter wakes up, and then she's in bed either between 12 and 12:30. All right, 12 o'clock, the time of the murder is somewhere around 12:45. That's when the police officer, the first officer on the scene, received the call and got there immediately. Mr. Cleveland was still alive. So somewhere shortly before 12:45. The apartment is located across town, just on the outskirts of Wilmington on Maryland Avenue. So it's, well, Wilmington's not a big city. It's 10-minute drive at most, 10, 15 minutes at most. Gives Mr. Dillard ample time to leave the apartment after his girlfriend went to bed, join his friends, become involved in this robbery turned murder, and then get back to the apartment in time for Tiara Flannery to wake up at 4 o'clock, or for, yes, Tiara Flannery to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to work and find her boyfriend in bed with her.
But so, Mr. Dillard testified that he left there, didn't he?
Yes, Mr. Dillard took the witness stand and said he was there all the time. But his alibi witness, Ms. Flannery, could only testify as to, well, depending, either 12 or 12:30, and then the gap
well,
before
why,
4 o'clock.
Why isn't his testimony alone sufficient to require an alibi instruction?
Well, I'm not arguing about now. I'm moved on to harmless error land here.
Well, there's one essential point. When you move on to harmless error land, you should take us with you.
I'm sorry. I thought
we're
I
not,
was responding.
We're
to,
not quite following where you're going.
All right. The well now. I suppose I could back up right now and say that had the judge here said, "I don't find the evidence presented credible." I think I could, in both cases, stand up here and defend that position. Now, that's not what happened. That's not what happened, and so I shouldn't be standing up here defending a position that the judge never took. So the only thing I can do is more or less make the same argument but cast it in a harmless error.
Well, why isn't it the jury that decides credibility?
I'm sorry?
Why doesn't the jury decide credibility, not the judge or you on appeal?
Well, under the statute, the judge has to decide as an initial matter, as a gatekeeping matter, whether there is some credible evidence to present to the jury.
But hasn't this court held that sworn testimony by a witness is credible evidence? And yeah. The jury, credible evidence for the purpose of getting the instruction. It's up to the jury to decide whether it's believable in that credible
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, credible in that way. So with Dillard, I think a judge could decide, again, I'm arguing harmless error here, that certainly the alibi witness, Ms. Flannery, simply doesn't cover the amount of time. Now, the defendant does, but I really don't know if a defendant, quite frankly, I'm ignorant on this point, whether an alibi instruction, an alibi defense means that you present alibi witnesses or whether you take the stand yourself and simply say, I was someplace else at the time. I'm not quite sure. I mean, an alibi defense is simply a part and parcel of the old defense. I wasn't there. If I was there, I didn't do it. And if I did do it, it was an accident. I mean, it was just the litany.
That was Justice Rizzi's question, if you recall. It was, why isn't the defendant saying he was somewhere else rather than at the time and place that the offense occurred sufficient credible evidence to support an alibi instruction?
Well, it seems to me that as the alibi instruction normally looks to some proof that of a defense present someplace else, not just I wasn't there. All right, that's fine. I wasn't there. I didn't do it if I was there. Those are just the general denials But if the defendant wants to take that one further and say, I was in Chicago and here are my plane tickets or my train tickets, here's my bill from my hotel, or present a witness saying, yes, he was in this place, then you're getting into what
counsel,
I'm sorry.
Are you arguing that the sworn testimony that I wasn't there, I was someplace else, is not alone enough, that there has to be some sort of corroboration in order for the evidence to be credible within the meaning of Jackson?
No, I'm arguing that I'm wondering, actually, because I don't know. I confess ignorance at this point. I don't know if a defendant getting on the stand and saying, I wasn't there, constitutes an alibi defense.
Is that something that was even presented to the trial judge?
No, in this case, Justice Risley asked, isn't the defendant's testimony alone enough? And I'm saying to Justice Risley in answer to his question, I don't know. I don't know whether the defendant has to offer something in addition to his own testimony that I wasn't there. You know, some proof of some kind, whether a witness or documentary evidence or something to show I was someplace else. That's what I look on, at least from a common sense point of view, as an alibi defense.
Could we get back to the harmless error?
Yeah.
Because I'm still waiting to be convinced that notwithstanding the failure to give this instruction, it wouldn't have made any difference because the state's case was so strong, and here's what it was that was so strong.
Right. Actually, it's not because the state's case was so strong, but because the alibi defenses were so weak. And I, again,
well,
to get off
second.
This.
Wait. Stop.
Yes.
In terms of harmless error, doesn't the harmless error standard work back from the idea that if this error hadn't taken place, the result of the trial might have been different? So don't we have to look at the whole strength of the state's case, not just the alibi defense, when deciding whether the failure to give that instruction was harmless?
Certainly. Certainly. The state's case hinges, of course, as my friend Ms. Walker pointed out, on the credibility of the two witnesses. If you believe them, these guys were there. I mean, there is no doubt about it. If you don't believe them, they're not there. I mean, and apparently the jury decided that credibility question against the defendant, in which case the evidence that they were there was locked tight. They weren't waffling on that issue. They knew these fellows. They knew them by their street name. But Garrett Dillard took the witness stand and confirmed that, yes, those are our street names. Both Ms. Clark and Ms. Brown were unequivocal in their statements to the police that they saw Bam and A.D. and whatever the other one's name is there, and that these two defendants were tussling with the victim, that is, were involved. There's no doubt that that's what they said. If they were believed, which the jury ended up believing them, then the case against Mr. Dillard and Mr. Brown was very strong. If they were not believed, then there was no case against them at all. This was an all-or-nothing kind of thing. You either believed them or you didn't.
But it was all-or-nothing based on the 3507 statements.
Yes. Strictly on the 3507 statements. If I said testimony, I didn't mean that. I mean, if you took their 3507 statements, their in-court testimony was they didn't know anything. They were drunk, they were high.
Mr. Donovan.
So when you weigh that, yes.
To hark back to the Chief Justice's question, you need to take us with you wherever you're going, and I'm not sure where you've gone.
I sometimes do go off on tangents. I'm sorry. Still on the addressing Justice Berger's question about convince us that the error was harmless.
Right, and Justice Berger said, isn't the test one that requires an analysis of whether, if this instruction were given, as is now conceded it should have been, yeah, the result might have been different? I haven't heard any response to that.
Yeah. Well, whether the state's case is strong, and the point I'm making here in answer to Justice Berger's question is that if you believe the two witnesses, Ms. Brown and Ms. Clark, then the state's case was very strong. If you disbelieve them, then the state had no case at all. contrasted to that were the...
How can you say the state's case was very strong when we have the 3507 statements that are inconsistent with the trial testimony?
Yes. That's the essential witness. The central problem with the state's case is convincing the jury to credit the 3507 statements against the witnesses in court appearance and testimony. And once you convince the jury...
Well, help us come out with your conclusion that the state's case was strong, notwithstanding those inconsistencies.
My point is that this is an all or nothing case. You either believe Ms. Clark and Ms. Brown. If you do, then the state's case is strong. But getting over that initial hurdle is a real problem. But if you convince the jury, if they, you know, take a look at the live witnesses on the witness stand, hear their testimony now in front of them, which is basically denials, and then consider their statements, which were videotaped, plus the officer's testimony, and then weigh which is the more credible. The jury obviously decided their initial statements to the police were the more credible, and for whatever reasons, they had decided to turn code witnesses by the time of trial. So my only point...
One of the concerns in Jackson was on the burden of proof. How can we tell there was harmless error when we don't know what the conversation was in the jury room? What if someone said, for example, I don't believe the alibi defense, and he hasn't proved his alibi defense, therefore he hasn't proved it, he's guilty. Hmm. But that doesn't comply with what the law is, does it?
No. I think this is what the trial judges... Judge Johnson's thinking was at the time she said, I don't want to emphasize this evidence. In other words, I don't want to put before you, emphasize to the jury this little piece, your, quite frankly, iffy alibi defenses. And I noted in my brief, and I'll say it again, that in closing argument, neither defense counsel placed a lot of emphasis on those alibi defenses. They placed their emphasis on where it actually should have been placed, without the credibility of Ms. Clark and Ms. Brown.
Well, the judge instructed the jury that the state has the burden of proof. The judge also instructed the jury the defendant does not have to produce any evidence on his own behalf. But there's a big gap, isn't there? Because there's no instruction on what happens if the defendant does. Who has the burden of proof of that? There's nothing on that.
There is nothing on the defendant's burden specifically, but then on the other hand, I point to those jurisdictions in which the alibi instruction is forbidden precisely for that reason, that when you emphasize to the jury something, a bit of simple defense, now not affirmative, that's totally different, that's confession and avoidance, but a simple defense, a denial, basically, I wasn't there. I was elsewhere. And if you emphasize the nature of that alibi, not only was I not there, I was there. I mean, if the jury can still find that the defendant's alibi, that he failed to prove he was in Chicago, but there's still not enough evidence to prove he was there. Who knows where he was, but he wasn't there at the scene of the crime.
So have you moved away from harmless error now, and are you suggesting that Jackson should be overruled?
No, I don't think. I have never argued that something should be overruled. I'm a great believer in stare decisis. I'm simply trying to argue harmless error, and that in this particular case, the failure to give an appropriate alibi instruction that does not shift the burden of persuasion over to the defendant was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt under the Van Arsdale standard. That's my only argument.
It's the because that we're looking for. That is the what follows after the because that gets appended to the end of the statement that you just made. Aren't you really arguing to us that the jury was required to disbelieve the alibi evidence as a matter of law?
No, I'm saying that the jury, whether or not the jury believed the alibi evidence, does not end their deliberations. In other words, the danger, I think, that the judge saw with an alibi instruction, and these other jurisdictions see with one, is that when you emphasize that, there's a tendency of the jury to say, well, if we disbelieve the alibi, that's the defense. If we disbelieve the defense, then he's guilty. And that's not what they should do. That is not disbelieving the alibi, fine. You still have to go on and say, was he there? If he was there, was he involved?
In fairness, it's not possible to conclude from the record we have that the reasoning you just provided was the trial judge's reasoning when she declined to give the requested alibi instruction, is it?
No, I'm extrapolating from her there. I don't want to emphasize. I think she did say that would emphasize this evidence.
What I understand her to have said is, first, to focus solely on the last sentence, which we've been over and over. And then she says simply, I find that it is an unnecessary commentary on the evidence, whatever that means. If I do that, I probably should list every single bit of evidence in the case and say, if this piece of evidence raises a reasonable doubt, you must find the defendant not guilty. I don't read her reasoning as benignly toward the defendant as you do. It doesn't sound to me like she's doing anything but saying, I'm not going to raise this alibi defense to the extraordinary level that if the jury has a reasonable doubt about whether he was there or not as a result of the evidence they hear about alibi, then they'll find him not guilty. I'm not going to let that happen. That's one possible way of reading what she says.
I have to disagree with Your Honor. I think my more benign reading is probably more in line with her thinking on the subject. I don't think she was thinking along the lines, gee, I'm giving the defendant a special break here. I think, honestly, why should I comment on one piece of evidence to the exclusion of another piece of evidence? I'm not. And I say, as the other jurisdictions, such as Illinois and Kansas and that one Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case, zero in on just that kind of thing.
Well, but they don't have the statutory framework with which we have to deal. So it doesn't matter what they say. You've already said it's a matter of state law. And then secondly, we have a statute we have to deal with.
Sure.
They must not come to the conclusion.
As a matter of fact, Illinois and Kansas, it's their pattern jury committee who have come out against that. And they do not. In Texas, they do not have the equivalent of 302.
Thank you.
Morning again, Your Honors. Your Honors, on the question about the record below, spoken to trial counsel, and at page A103 of Dillard's appendix, there's a discussion held off the record, and then the court comes back on the record, and the court reports Mr. Figueroa and Mr. Vieth are requesting the court consider an alibi instruction. I understand the request from trial counsel was for the pattern alibi instruction. And no particular text may have been handed up to the court at that time. And then...
So what supports that is the earlier reference we heard when the trial judge referred to, quoted the one sentence and said it's the, quote, operative part, close quote.
Exactly.
Which suggests there's something more to it than that sentence.
And then in page A132 in Chambers, later that same day perhaps, the court says, I have reviewed the alibi instruction, the operative part of it says. And so... Counsel's recollection is that the standard instruction was being asked for earlier in the day and then discussed in chambers later in the day, and that's
okay.
Text was not made part of the record, unfortunately, Your Honors. The court also heard questions about Jackson and Gardner to counsel. Those decisions are crystal clear about it being a mandatory thing. The court cites back the Halko in Jackson and Gardner, not to 303, and my sense is that maybe that's the common law of the jurisdiction, perhaps back in Halko was 1961. Criminal code came into effect in 1973, the modern criminal code. And so the court's looking back to prior precedent, essentially, not to the statute. But Gardner says, Your Honor, in a murder case, we have a murder case here, but here Dillard's serving a life sentence, where alibi is the defendant's main or sole defense, which it was here. They offered no other defense case but alibi. The proffered evidence against the defendant is all or mostly circumstantial. The possible punishment is severe, which is here a life sentence, or where a case is so complex an instruction necessary in the interest of justice, sua sponte, to respond to Justice Holland's concern, because the Gardner trial counsel failed to ask for it, which is less than what occurred here. So I would submit sua sponte, a plain error, that it should have happened here, even if it was done imperfectly in the trial court. Mr. Donovan's references other states is a red herring, frankly, because we don't know that other states have a statutory scheme that mandates things as our statute does here, our legislature has done here, so they cannot be relied upon as other jurisdictions. And the case of Redmond versus State that was overturned on habeas relief discusses harmless error and finds it prejudicial, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I think we beat this to death, so...
I think your time is up.
It is.
Is that the same thing as
because
beating
Because we beat it to death.
I have one question.
Yes.
Your client, Brown, did or did not testify?
He did not testify.
Did not testify. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Right.